You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the summer of 1936, poet, film critic, screenwriter, and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist James Agee and the great photographer Walker Evans traveled to the Cotton Belt to document the lives of impoverished sharecropping families on assignment for Fortune magazine. That led to their collaboration on the groundbreaking book Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, but Fortune never ran the original article. In 2010, the manuscript for that assignment turned up in a trove of documents found in the New York apartment Agee had lived in. It's now being released as a book called Cotton Tenants, Three Families, published by Melville House, and I'm very delighted to welcome the book's co-editors, novelist Adam Hazlett and John Summers, editor of the Baffler magazine, to our show today. Hello.
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 Adam, have people wondered why Fortune never published the article that Agee and Evans were sent to report?
It's been a question all along, and as I think John can tell you as well, we have no documentation or letters or correspondence that really tells us exactly why they didn't. I mean, the length is one obvious thing, but it's a bit of a mystery. John knows a lot about that period.
Well, would Fortune, which represents a certain attitude about America, have found this a little too far to the left?
It's possible. It's possible. Fortune was an interesting place in the early 30s. They were changing politically. Agee had written before for them. In fact, he wrote a story on the Tennessee Valley Authority that Henry Luce praised as the best writing that Fortune had yet published. So, and in fact, Agee wrote then subsequently many stories for Fortune. So it wasn't such a clear and fast distinction.
Well, he wrote for Luce because he was film critic at Time magazine.
That's right. One of the things that we do know, though, is that it's not true that James Agee turned in an unpublishable piece, because we have it and it's quite nice.
Well, how was the manuscript discovered over 50 years after Agee's death?
Well, discovery is a bit of a difficult word in this context. I had been in touch with the James Agee estate since around 2005. There were some efforts to open up the literary community surrounding Agee at the time. And the head of the Agee Trust, Paul Strecker, simply called me and told me about the manuscript. So it was a...
It was sitting there and they knew that...
It had been recognized for sort of what it is. It wasn't just a rough draft of Let Us Not Praise Famous Men. It wasn't a treatment. It was, in fact, a fully realized magazine journalism.
So did it need any editing?
Well, the manuscript is about... The typescript was about 90 pages. And in each page, there were multiple marks, all of them Agee's, all of them, believe it or not, legible. He had terrible handwriting. All that I did in editing it was to follow his instructions. So God forbid that I should edit James Agee. Yeah.
And then John called me to see if I would write an introduction, which I did, so I didn't participate so much in the editing as trying to wrestle with it as a document and wonder what is the relevance of it today for us. And what struck me was what a live and still intense and vivid account it was. And how much more than an introduction to Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, or rather a precursor. And one of the distinctions you could make is that if Let Us Now Praise Famous Men is a kind of sui generis prose symphony, this is like a poet's brief for the prosecution of social and political injustice.
Yes, that's beautifully put. I think.
And so I think it really does stand on its own. I think in time could come to be understood as a kind of classic of American journalism that just happened never to be published.
But is it relevant today, or is it very much about a certain time in American history?
Well, no, I think it's quite relevant, and the reason is twofold. One is that it is about a disparity of economic conditions between landlords and tenants and a system of debt that we now have a simply late capital version of, with the crisis in student debt and consumer debt and so on. So I think the economic relations that he's describing are simply now exist in another register. But also he has this notion of the intuitions that allow an economic system to thrive. It's not just that there's a cold economic logic, as he calls it. There's also a system of assumptions. And in our time, those assumptions have to do with the fact that debt is just natural law, and you know, every debt is a personal moral obligation as opposed to part of a system that's rigged towards creditors.
The photographs and texts follow three representative families, representative with quotes around it.
That's right, yes.
How were those families chosen?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, I think he does talk about that, actually.
I mean, because they are representative. He sees them as representative.
That's right.
Well, he does and he doesn't. You know, one of the interesting things that Adam says in his introduction is that there's no scandal here. There's no sensationalism. There's no what Agee calls a kind of flagrant example of the underlying patterns that he's trying to disclose. So he may call them representative, but he wouldn't – I don't know. Maybe the proper word is typical.
Well, where did they fall in the class structure of the South at the time, or even,
I think, very close to the bottom. I mean, one of the interesting things –
he called them white trash. Well, you can't do that anymore.
One of the interesting things that Melville House and John did with the editing of this is put a couple of appendix in at the end, and one is about the plight of black farmers because – and he says, of course, their condition is even worse than that which they're representing here. And so I think they are in a position of the lowest on the economic totem pole within the white South.
Well, there is a Walker Evans photograph of black children, but that doesn't seem to be something that they were thinking very much about at the time.
Well, no, he's explicit that he's not taking on that larger question of race relations in the South, though he does have an incredible line towards the end about the sadism of the relationship between white landowners and their black tenants.
Had Agee written anything like this before?
No. And he had lots of apprehension about the assignment. There's a couple.
So he was sent to do this.
That's right. Yeah, he was sent.
He said, I must report on this important problem in America.
Well, the fact is that Northern journalists going down to the South to report back to their Northern readers was already a hackneyed assignment by the time Agee got his. It had been going on for some time, but that it was going on in Henry Luce's Fortune magazine, a business magazine. It lent it a sort of political tension. Agee thought it was a great opportunity. He said it was the best assignment that he'd ever gotten.
Well, Walker Evans had taken photographs like this before.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, the photographs that are in this book, some of them not published before, how come they didn't make it into Let Us Now Praise Famous Men? There's this pretty great photographs here.
These are wonderful photographs. That's right. I mean, yeah. You know, would that we knew more about what happened between the 1936 assignment and the publication of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men in 1941. But there's surprisingly little documentary evidence. It's perhaps because Agee was a staff writer and much of this business was transacted orally within the building. He was at the Chrysler Building.
Yeah. We're talking with John Summers and Adam Hazlett about Cotton Tenants, Three Families, a collaboration of James Agee and Walker Evans. Did Agee's former writings, such as his screenplays for The African Queen and The Night of the Hunter, prepare him for such an ambition? Well, he wrote some of those afterward. But, I mean, did his other writings prepare him for this sort of thing?
Well, I think that what comes through in reading this and what a lot of readers might find interesting in the contrast to a lot of contemporary journalism is the poetic force of the language. I mean, it's by no means as broad and metaphysical as Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, but it is... in many ways, that restraint makes it a text that sings with a kind of poetic intensity in his descriptions of the land and the people. But it's with a political force to it. So when I say it's a poet's brief for the prosecution of social injustice, it is something that's meant to be preached in a way. It's journalism that's a kind of indignant moral anthropology.
Was that something new in American journalism, where the goal, at least theoretically, has always been to be objective?
Well, there were the muckraking press of the late 19th century and early 20th century is the obvious precursors for what AG is doing in that larger political sense. Although
I think the point John made earlier is that here it's complicated enough that there isn't simply a villain that you're going after in the form of the landowners. Because he's such a good writer, there's this combination of writerly intelligence and political acumen that leads to something much greater than the sum of the parts.
Did his style influence other journalists?
Well, his style, remember, yes, it did. Of course, it influenced journalists who were grouped themselves or thought of themselves as some new journalism movement in the 1960s.
That was the previous new journalism movement.
That's right. Yes, but the you know, AG's work was for a small community of people in the 40s and the 50s. He didn't have broad influence until after he died and after Let Us Now Praise Famous Men was published in 1960 in particular.
And then A Death in the Family. I was assigned that for a college writing class. I guess our teacher wanted us to see how you could write a simple thing about watering a lawn and make it into literature.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned the novel because this really is the answer to your earlier question about what prepared him for this. He was, of course, born in Knoxville. He was a Southerner. And born in 1909, and he came north and he worked. You know, he went to school at Harvard, and he had executed this parody of Henry Luce's new style in journalism. So Luce therefore hired him on the advice of Dwight MacDonald.
Were they sent down there together as a decision by editors, or did they like collaborating with each other?
Well, there was a section of the magazine called Life and Circumstances that Fortune wanted him to cover, and then it was A.G. who actually requested Evans be the photographer that he'd take with him.
His descriptions are so acute. How much time did he spend with the families that they were writing about?
I believe he was there for 2 months.
And was he affected by it? Do we know whether this changed some attitudes in him?
Well, I don't know that it changed his attitudes. I think that he felt that probably his attitudes at the time were ill-formed enough that they needed forming. And I think he took this assignment with a kind of openness that is in large measure responsible for what he was able to achieve.
He writes about race. He mentions that that the landowners preferred to have black families working for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's part of this structure of intuition that I was talking about, which is that he says at some point that the culture he's writing about is a dizzying mix of feudalism and capitalism in its later stages. And I think that's the relevance for the book today is that he is showing the way that a journalist can analyze a circumstance of great economic disparity with not just a set of numbers or statistics, which we're all very familiar with, but with a kind of descriptive power that gives it moral force.
Well, did he interact with them, or did he try to be an anthropologist and
yes,
just observe?
No, indeed. I mean, he lived right in, you know, beside them and spent most of each day with them. And some of the descriptions of picking cotton and what their hands look like at the end of a cotton picking season and all of that is incredibly vivid, and it sort of commands the reader's attention in a way that a newspaper article or even a lot of long-form journalism today just simply doesn't.
The journalist Dale Maharaj and the photographer Michael Williamson went back to find these families and their descendants in the late 1980s, and their book and their children after them won a Pulitzer Prize in 1990. Had their lives turned out to be as grim as A.G. had predicted?
Well, I think yes and no. I think one of the questions that A.G. is trying to get at is the extent to which these families had internalized their condition, which he thought was more or less catastrophic. And I think that it's, you know, there was some complaints about the book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, that it had represented the lives of these three families, you know, in a fairly harsh light. As if they had been prisoners of their entirely and lacking a certain kind of self-consciousness. And there, I think, in part was a reflection of the kind of shame that A.G. writes about in a very beautiful and important way in Let Us Now Praise Famous Men that's more or less absent from this much more truncated report. But we were happy to learn that the descendants of the Fields family were very happy to see that this book was being published, Cotton Tenants. And in this way, I think there's progress. about recognizing the kind of shared burdens that we're under.
We posted a wonderful slideshow of some of Walker Evans' photos on our show page at WNYC.org. We see on one of them, we see a general store. Would that be the sharecropper's main source of supplies?
You know, these are questions that time transport might only answer in terms of the experience that they might have had down there. I mean, I think what's relevant as an economic system, and certainly would have been true of a general store, is that there's the phenomenon of people being paid on script. I mean, essentially they get credit at a store to get their supplies in order to plant their cotton and feed their family and clothe their family. And then they are essentially in hock before they've even earned money. To the landlord, much in the way, I might add for its relevance, that a student today comes out with a mortgage on their head before they get out of college with the debt that they're subsumed under. And today it's a lot more abstract and you don't know your landlord. It's a multinational bank.
The reason I ask that is I'm assuming that the sharecroppers were also in debt to the store owner as well.
Precisely.
To the landowner.
Yeah.
People who know something about photography will recognize many of the family that Walker Evans photographed in this book from some of the other photographs he took for the Farm Securities Administration. They are amazing photographs. I don't know whether they were seen as revolutionary at the time, but
and you have them on the website.
And we have some on the website, so people get a sense of what we're talking about. And my great thanks to both of you for being here to talk about Cotton Tenants, Three Families by James Agee and Walker Evans. My guests have been Adam Hazlett and John Summers. The book is published by Melville House.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.